I want some Hoagie Carmichael before we go, too.
Okay. We got. I got that. I got quite a bit of Hoagie Carmichael. Okay, so there we go. Here's a little bit of The Cure. Well, actually, the whole song. And we'll be right back here on Radio Mysterio, so with Mac Tonies and Paul Kimball. That was The Cure, Killing an Arab. It's Radio Mysterioso, and we're back with our guest, Paul Kimball Mac Tonies, right?
Yep.
Is that your real name?
It's my real name.
It's on your driver's license.
It's not short for anything either. No, oh. Mac. That's it. I'd like to just cut out the Tonies because it confuses people and just go by Mac. You know, kind of like Sting or
yeah, it also makes you sound like a character from a 1930s novel or something.
I like that. It's like a Raymond Chandler thing.
Exactly. You know, because of you talk about Burroughs a lot on your... We'll get back to UFOs. You talk about Burroughs a lot on your blog and on your website.
Yeah.
And actually, I've listened to more Burroughs than I've read.
Yeah. He's great to listen to. I've got his debut album, Call Me Burroughs, on CD, which was released in the 90s. Good one. And
have you got the Naropa stuff off of Archive?
No, I do not have it.
No, I don't. There's a great lecture on there called "Technology and the Ethics of Wishing,"
which
lays me out every time. I've listened to it probably 10 or 15 or 20 times. I don't know how many times.
Is it one of those box sets?
It's for free on archive.org.
Okay,
you can download it.
Okay, that's it. I got broadband internet now. It's mine. Consider it mine.
Right, but I forgot why I was gonna. Oh, you know what? I don't remember what I was going to say about that, but I do remember what I wrote down, and the fact that you read, you know, Gibson and Burroughs and the cyberpunk genre, utopianism, all this. How does that inform or affect your thought, your study of UFO stuff? Because it really affects me. I mean, it's a way of looking at things. I know that it's the same with Nick. And a few other people I know that are interested in UFOs.
It's interesting because I'm a guest at a science fiction convention in Kansas City, which I shirked my duty, didn't go to it last year, and didn't tell anybody. So I need to be thinking about how I approach it this year. But it's interesting, the science fiction and UFOs, to the layperson who's not into either of them, you'd think that they'd go hand in hand. And they don't. Usually science fiction fans are generally... any interest in UFOs.
Right.
And
science fiction writers stay away from it as much as possible, and they can't stand it.
It's rich material, and except for John Shirley's Silicon Embrace and Whitley Strieber's Majestic, which is a really good book.
That's my favorite Strieber UFO book.
It's haunting. It's the only book I've ever read twice.
Really?
Yeah.
Majestic, really.
Majestic by Whitley Strieber.
Huh.
I just thought it was creepy and splendidly weird. I really liked it. And let me see. But, yeah, the science fiction community is very hostile to UFOs because they liked it. It's like they know they're a marginal community, and they don't want to...
Why associate themselves with it?
Yeah, why go any lower, you know? Why ghettoize themselves with UFOs? And it's their own loss because it's a rich, rich source of ideas and metaphors. And
yeah.
I've
clawed my way to the top of science fiction fandom. Why do I want to,
exactly. And it's just, they're both communities just repel each other like same pole and a magnet.
Uh-huh.
But you wouldn't expect that. Some people wouldn't expect that. And it's interesting to discover that when you go to a science fiction convention or a UFO convention. There's no mingling of the two. It's oil and water.
Uh-huh. And the funny thing is some very good science fiction writers have no problem with it, a few of them.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to write a UFO novel very much, but it'd be, it's difficult getting...
Burroughs had him in his novels. He talked about it.
Yeah.
He went and stayed at Whitley Strieber's cabin two or three times trying to get an abduction experience, and he got mad when he didn't get one.
Yeah, I didn't get one. I
asked Strieber about it, and he said Burroughs was such a cool guy. It was so nice having him there. We had great conversations. It's like...
I bet it was fun.
I would have paid money, lots of money, to sit there that weekend, just watch them talk.
Exactly. I'd like to see this, to have a podcast of that. But I went and saw Burroughs in Lawrence, Kansas, very shortly before Allen Ginsberg died. And then, of course, Burroughs died not too long after that. But it was Ports of Entry. It was William S. Burroughs and the Arts in the Spencer Museum. And it was a great show, and no one knew that Burroughs was coming to this thing.
Wow.
Even though it was in Lawrence, and it was like, why wouldn't he? But he showed up, walked in, and everyone was just flabbergasted. And I actually asked him a question about the Marie Celeste, which is a kind of a recurring theme in some of his later books.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
I was looking at some of his art, and it referenced Roswell and stuff, and he had a definite interest in the whole crash saucer idea and government cover-ups. And
you know what else is weird about Burroughs, and something he embraced, that another thing, the kind of thing that other science fiction writers and people would call pseudoscience, he's really into Wilhelm Reich.
Yeah, very much so.
And like he said, he had an Orgone box. He actually credited it.
He still used part of it
to his longevity.
Somebody in the audience asked him. They said, "Do you still use your Orgone box?" And he said, "Yeah, weather permitting," or something like that. Right.
Yeah.
He said he was still using that up to his last breath.
Maybe I should go back to my. Well, you know what I was going to ask you, where your sympathies lie with the research and the theories and all that, but we've kind of gone through that and talked about it. But actually, Paul, is there somebody, any person or group of people you look to as, they kind of got it, and I like to listen to them because good ideas come out of that segment of the research community? Is there names, organizations?
Sure. There's tons of people. Dick Hall. Brad Sparks.
Really? Richard Hall.
I like Dick Hall, yeah. Dick, he's in our film, or he will be, sorry. We've interviewed him. We're going back to re-interview him in Washington.
It's funny, because to me, he's the kind of person that's like the polar opposite of what you were saying about, the extraterrestrial hypothesis and being stuck in that mold.
But I don't think Dick's stuck in the extraterrestrial hypothesis
really?
Mode. And I don't know.
You know him a lot, but you've talked to him. I haven't.
Yeah, I don't have a problem with people who are stuck in the ETH mode. I just disagree about conclusions, but that doesn't mean we can't agree.
Yeah, but I mean stuck and not open-minded about it.
No, I think Dick's fairly open-minded.
Is he?
I think Kevin Randall is too, and he's a person a lot of people would associate with the ETH.
No, I have a lot more respect for Randall than I do for Dick Hall, but maybe I just don't. All I know is from what I've read of his recent writings, going back maybe 10 or 15 years.
Dick's become somewhat curmudgeonly, but I don't necessarily blame him. He's devoted a better part of his life to researching the UFO phenomenon, first with NICAP and later with FUFOR, and also his UFO evidence books, which are should be must reading for anybody who's even remotely interested in the subject.
As a basis,
Jerry Clark is another good guy. I mean, a lot of young guys. There was a group called I won't name them, but the RRR, the RRR group, who made a wave in ufology about a year ago. And they
is that the one with the website that was like really? They sounded very above it all, kind
of. Yeah, and they
very
were
aloof.
Yeah, they were a bunch of young guys led by an older guy who went around and basically trashed ufologists. And
they had a flowchart posted on their blog, and I played a major role in that. You remember that?
Yeah, oh, really? Yeah.
Which was all part of the conspiracy that the Caped Avenger looked into when you kidnapped Zorgroth.
I was never quite sure where I fit into this scheme, but it was compelling.
They were troublemakers, and their purpose was to cause trouble, and in some senses they were trolls. But they raised sometimes some pretty good points that I happen to agree with.
Thought they were assholes, but they were smart assholes.
Well, I don't even know about smart, but I do agree with the first one.
Occasionally.
But occasionally they made points that were valid. But just because, you know, Jerry Clark or Dick Hall might be wrong about this or that doesn't mean that they haven't done a great deal of work, work, and we should be thankful for that. But those guys aren't getting any younger. So the truth is that we need to look to a new generation of people who can go out there and do serious research. And, you know, I think I've named some of those people. There are others. You can see some of their names on UFO updates.
Uh-huh.
But
I interrupted you, though, when you were going through the name place.
Sorry.
Yeah, Cole.
The day of, I was talking with Brad Sparks, who I think is probably the best UFO researcher of the last 25 years in terms of interviewing people, of getting documentation. I don't always agree with all of Brad's conclusions, but he's, you know, he's walked the walk, so he's entitled to talk the talk.
Right, right.
But the day of the UFO organizations is dead. You know, QFOS, FUFOR, MUFON, all of that. Some of them still exist in some form or another, but the Internet's changed all that.
Yeah.
And I think ufology to...
The Internet killed the ufology store.
Some of the old-line ufologists have just failed to keep up with that. Jerry Clark doesn't have a website. Dick Hall does, but it's not regularly
keep
updated.
Keep going, I'm going to answer the phone.
Sure. Stan does, but it's not regularly updated. But then you get guys like Tim Banal, who come out of the woodwork and starts interviewing people and podcasting. And, you know, who's Tim Banal? He's a guy from Boston who just took an interest in UFOs. And yet he actually goes out and talks to people and puts the interviews up on the net. And the Internet, for good and ill, is the future of ufology.
Yeah. 99, Sturgeon's Law, science fiction writer Theodore Sturgeon, someone asked him why 99% of science fiction was crap, and I'm probably misquoting it, but I'm getting the gist of it across, and he said, well, that's because 99% of everything is crap.
Yeah.
Yeah, why pick on science fiction?
I love that quote. It was Sturgeon, yeah.
Sturgeon,
my
yeah.
dear man, 99% of everything is crap.
He
yeah.
was the model for Kilgore Trout of Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he got Theodore, and he got Kilgore, he got the gore in there,
uh-huh.
and then he got a fish.
Oh, right, makes sense.
There we go.
And if it was a dead fish, it would be Al Gore. But I'm okay. I'm here twice on Saturdays, folks. I say the future of ufology is the Internet. It is, to some degree. But I would hope that there's an institutional future for ufology. But it's not going to be these organizations that have been run by the seat of their pants. You need money. You need significant funding, probably from the government or from private institutions, and that's going to require ufology.
That was tried a couple of times in the last 10 years.
Yeah, you don't want to take it from just one guy, like Robert Bigelow, with whatever agenda he might be bringing with him. It needs to come from a broad-based effort. You need to involve, as much as some people might dislike hearing this, mainstream science.
Right, yeah, this is a problem with mainstream science, too, because your results depend on a lot of times who the funding agency is.
I think it's interesting, Paul noted that, you know, these aging dinosaurs, you know, that they grew up in an era where the universe was very much different than what we have now. Now we have this very plastic cosmology with serious talk about parallel universes, parallel worlds.
And I'm old enough or young enough to be amazed that I heard radio and saw pictures from a planet of Saturn and a moon of Saturn.
Yeah. Yeah. Which one?
Yeah.
You got all these great, great photographs coming in. But yeah, we're living in
the lander,
the Huygens on Titan. Yeah.
Right.
That was an incredible moment.
I played the audio from that one time on the show with the sped up radar. Yep. Just sounds like whoo.
Oh, I heard that. Yeah.
There
are some neat space sounds online.
Uh huh.
Ask yourself this. What was the, I ranked the top 10 events in ufology last year. And the biggest event to me was the ABC documentary. Like it or not like it, it reached millions of people. I mean, that's huge.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And the first
that
hour
was a catalyst
great.
For somebody we're going to be hearing about in 5 or 10 years, maybe.
Yeah, but the moment, and Michio Kaku is not a ufologist by any means, but when you can get a guy like Kaku to come in, one of our top theoretical physicists, and at the end of the show say, you know what? Let's keep an open mind about this.
Right, right.
And then go to his website and read some of the articles he writes about the possibilities of interstellar travel,
right.
Von Neumann probes, robotics, all that sort of stuff.
Right.
He's setting out a sort of a paradigm shift in how you're looking at UFOs if they are extraterrestrial. And it explains, if you start thinking, well, okay, maybe they're not little green men from Zeta Reticuli. Maybe they're robots. And this is why some of Mac's writing, is, I find fascinating, the concept of transhumanism, posthumanism, the singularity, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
You know, maybe we're 20 or 30. We've been joking all week about Borg phones, the little things they wear in the ears.
Yeah,
Bluetooth things.
Yeah.
Things are moving so fast, in 10 years they might actually have those things, you know, surgically implanted into their brain.
Years.
Yeah. Well, there's a guy in England that's already doing that.
Yeah.
Who's that scientist? He's implanting all kinds of stuff in his body.
He's kind of using himself as a guinea pig.
Uh-huh.
So we have to broaden.
It'll be like the president's analyst. Remember that film? It's from the late 60s. The phone company actually implants phones in people, saying it's a lot more convenient. But they're basically using it as to kind of mind control and get everybody, you know, in line with what the phone company wants to do. And the big evil in the world is actually the phone company, not the Soviets.
Interesting. But the phones were so big back then. Where do they implant them? In, like, the rear end or something?
Well,
just the electronics part.
Oh, okay.
You know.
I was going to say I've never seen the president's analyst, but I have seen the president's analyst. It was a Bill Clinton, Monica Lewinsky production. Like I said, twice on Saturdays, folks. But ufology is, thank you. Ufology has so long looked at just the concept that, and the abduction people are a perfect example. These must be sentient beings. And I would say, who knows what sentient beings are going to look like on this planet in, say, 100 years.
Right.
And
you need to
broaden your mind.
Right. I would be very highly doubtful in 100 years, in 1,000 years, I think the whole idea, Philip K. Dick was onto this ahead of his time, separating the living from the non-living, you know, it's going to be futile. And in a very short amount of time. And if we are indeed being visited
in our way, the separating the living from the non-living was already thought about, you know, thousands of years ago. It's part of the basis of some religions.
Right.
But we're thinking of it in a technological way.
Technological, right. But, you know, what is you can look at the human body and, you know, what is it? But you can reduce it to a machine, you know. You can, you know, there's evidence that, it's perhaps more than the sum of its parts, but nevertheless. And you look at machines, you know, they're becoming more like living systems. And I would be very surprised if we are dealing with extraterrestrials, if that's one of the applicable
in the way we think of it, coming from another planet, a living being.
I would be surprised if it's flesh and blood aliens in tin can spaceships, even if they are, gravity-defined. I would expect something along the lines of self-replicating probes and a machine intelligence, something that arrives.
That's funny, because abductees sometimes describe it that way.
Yeah, I know. You got these really interesting accounts. And another thing about nanotechnology, we always hear, you know, like Eric Drexler talking about, you built a spaceship in a vat. You know, it's grown, basically, by microscopic machines. And there are no rivets. And you look at accounts of people who are taken inside, or reported to have been taken inside flying saucers, for lack of a better term, and they describe seamless, sourceless lighting, very rounded contours.
Right.
And that's all very suggestive to me of molecular nanotechnology in action.
Yeah, but where would it come from?
Yeah, I don't think we're there yet. So that would imply that we're not making these things.
Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, where would it come from? Well, from another planet or another dimension, probably. And I think most people now agree, I would think, that there is probably, and I mean scientists, not your average guy on the street, that there is probably life on other planets in our universe, and at least, and probably in our galaxy, and maybe even in our interstellar neighborhood, or intrastellar neighborhood, galactic neighborhood, as Stan would say.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what are we looking at? We send little robots up to Mars. We haven't sent people. The first thing we sent out are robots. So maybe, and they're much more advanced than us, maybe they would send out robots.
Yeah, but we're still thinking of it in a travel from here to there in a certain amount of time kind of thing.
Sure.
And when you're saying these things, go ahead.
If they're warping space or using some of these other technologies that are well beyond us.
That still involves doing something to something that sounds mechanical that we can perceptualize.
Yeah. Well, I think that's probably what
it might be beyond that.
Well, maybe it is.
Because I talked to, you know who Dean Radin is? He's a parapsychologist. He wrote a book called The Conscious Universe.
Yeah, I do know him.
Yeah, he sat down with me one time during an interview, and I was going to interview him for like an hour or two at this place.
Did he do Entangled Minds?
I don't think so. No.
Okay, I don't know where. Sorry about that.
By the end of the conversation, this was at lunch. We sat down at, 11. We were talking, and then we were sitting there talking, and I noticed when I looked up and realized what was going on, they were saying, could you please move? We're serving dinner. Mm-hmm. And I recorded this whole conversation. And when I listened back to the conversation, I realized what he was trying to do was use language to get me out of the idea that time was, one, not linear, necessarily linear, and two, not necessarily existed.
Mm.
So that all possible, the way he was saying that we can't get our minds around it because we're physical and we age and things seem to happen in the way we perceive things seems to happen in a sequence, cause and effect, time flows from the future to the past. But at the end of it, I don't know how he did it, but he got me thinking in a way that where there was no time anymore.
Right. This is really good.
How could that work possibly? I mean, it's like a 4D. I mean, like the language is bad, but you can sort of grasp at this thing where, this stuff might be happening, but it might be happening all around us all the time. But only once in a while are we able to pull it into our kind of, be it by a plasma in the air or some kind of thing in our brains we don't know about or being in a certain place at a certain time. Sorry.
You have a hot spot.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a Wi-Fi, paranormal Wi-Fi hot spot.
Yeah, exactly.
That kind of concept opens up a whole lot of doors, though, and they're very interesting doors, and one of those doors is religion, which is something that sends almost every ufologist screaming through another door.
Except Jacques Vallée.
Yeah, except Jacques Vallée.
And Barry Downing, for some reason.
Barry Downing's a good guy. Met him, interviewed him once, a bright guy, and has some interesting ideas. His book, The Bible and Flying Saucers, is, I think, a classic of ufological literature, whether you agree with it or not.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the fundamental concepts that underlies almost any religion, including the Christian religion, is that God is eternal, meaning he can transcend time. Time doesn't exist for God. There was a Canadian evangelist in the 18th century, Henry Allen, I studied when I was working on my MA in history, who referred to it as the eternal now. Yesterday, the Beatles called it Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, which was a wonderful album. And
yes,
God can transcend time. Well, what if 10,000 years in the future, assuming we're still here, we learn how to transcend time, whether through mechanical means or whether we just create an understanding of the universe.
Yeah,
you're talking about
the way we're talking about it now, that exists now.
Yeah.
We're not talking about thousands of years in the future. We're talking about everything going on, every possibility going on right now and always has been and always will be.
Are you talking about the many worlds interpretation?
No, I'm talking about just a singularity where everything is going on at all the time. And if you can get to the point where you can access that, then the time doesn't make any difference anymore.
Well, that's one way of looking at it for sure.
Right.
The other way of looking at it is that at some point we'll discover that time, through whatever means, is nonlinear, and that we'll be able to manipulate, like Doctor Who or something like that.
Right.
And we come back through time and we become our own God. And in a very real sense, we become the UFO knots and everything else.
That's funny. That's what Western magicians have been trying to do for hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah.
That's very Frank Tipler. His proposal in the physics of immortality was that supercomputers that harness the power of the big crunch at the end of the universe, assuming there is the big crunch.
Sounds like Douglas Adams.
Huge tower.
Hello.
Oh, lots of ifs in this book, but but his basic idea is that these supercomputers will be powerful enough to simulate everything that ever happened to such an accurate degree that it'll be indistinguishable from reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that sense, it fulfills biblical prophecy of resurrecting the dead. And his book is very, you want to strangle him sometimes reading this book because it's a lot of supposition and it got justly slammed. But nevertheless, some interesting ideas. If you could harness enough computational power, like a neutron star or something, I don't know, and used it to simulate something and make it so exact. And that's one thing I was talking about.
That's the basis of the Hindu religion, actually, a lot of that.
Yeah. Some interesting parallels with Hinduism.
Yeah.
One idea that's been kicked around for years, actually, but it's becoming more in vogue now that we're getting better and better with virtual reality and computers, and it's getting becoming the bigger part of our life, is the idea that one possible solution to the Fermi paradox, and I use paradox in quotes because I don't think there is one, but the reason we haven't detected radio signals or seen mega-scale engineering in the night sky or whatever is because aliens upload themselves into a computer environment and basically become addicted to virtual environments where things are better than the real world. And we're heading in that direction right now. We're becoming more insulated.
We're already there.
Right, yeah. We're
practically.
We're heading there. We're definitely heading there right now. And, you know, and in that case, that civilization's not going to have any interest in sending signals and searching because they might invent a much more interesting universe for themselves and not even know the difference.
Yeah.
That opens up a philosophical can of worms because perhaps we're living in a regressive, constructed universe and ourselves.
Yeah. And that seems a lot more ridiculous and yet a lot more possible than a bunch of guys decided they need to come down here and replenish their DNA. They're abducting people and impregnating them and, you know.
Right. And it's doubly absurd if we're dealing with actual extraterrestrials, because the fact that they could use our DNA in any practical way it kind of begs belief. Bud Hopkins and his wife Carol Rainey co-wrote a really good book called Sight Unseen. And
I heard them talk about that, and then I made fun of them without reading the book because I just listened to their lecture. I figured, I heard it from the horse's mouth. They just said, the reason we're not seeing this is because they're invisible. I said, that's perfect.
There we go. Yeah, that's a valid point. But I did enjoy the book, and they make.
Well, then I should pick it up. And I'm sorry I spoke too soon.
No, yeah, I think you had it.
Don't feel
right to that. Don't feel too sorry.
I have another view. So,
Carol Rainey supplied these running commentary on transgenic technology.
Right. And
basically,
Paul told me this.
Yeah, the old wisdom that non-humans and humans would not be genetically compatible in any sense, even in a laboratory environment, we're proving that to be false. You know, any alien civilization could utilize their DNA, and if they're based on, but they have to be based on DNA.
Yeah.
On the other hand, I would say, and now look, I'll sound like Stan Friedman, all of this is very interesting and fascinating and should be talked about, but it is possible that there are alien civilizations out there.
Of course.
Sending nuts and bolts spacecraft here, and that's what we've seen.
Of course it is.
So, but the problem is, none of these things, as we've talked about, are necessarily mutually exclusive.
Right,
and you mentioned the name of a guy that I consider one of the three or four top UFO researchers, thinkers as well, period. And that's Jacques Vallée. And why is he not in ufology anymore? Or he's only tangentially in ufology. Just recently made an appearance last year.
I asked him that myself.
Yeah.
One time.
Well, that's a question ufology should ask itself. You know, why did Jacques Vallée leave? Or at least go underground for all intents and purposes.
Interestingly, he wrote the introduction to Dolan's UFOs in the National Security State.
Yeah, I'm not sure he read it. That's uncalled for, Rich.
I asked him to write one for Project Beta, but he never answered me.
I'm surprised. That seems like it's much more up his... I don't know. That's surprising to me.
It's not surprising to me because there's probably inter-ufologist government political stuff that he doesn't want to be involved with or be close to.
And that's probably why he got out, period.
Well, and a lot of the infighting, too. And I think it was because in the United States, it's different in other countries.
I have a ton of respect for him. He's one of my, you know, pillars of my...
I read Dimensions, and that was an epiphany. I totally, my thinking about UFOs was totally altered by him.
The ETH has been the dominant sort of theory in the United States for 20 years, maybe 30.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't in the rest of the world necessarily, but it has been here. And I think somebody like Vallée had trouble, he didn't have trouble fitting in. It's just the establishment, and it sounds weird to say that, doesn't it? The UFO establishment had trouble accepting some of the things that he was going beyond where they were happy where they were.
Yes.
Here's our comfort zone,
yeah.
Our little box.
He made a good comment about American ufology wanting to kick the tires, very Western attitude.
Mm-hmm.
So we were committed to a very physical, palpable theory like the ETH.
I asked him, I said, why aren't you doing any UFO stuff anymore? I mean, your work was important. It can continue to be important. People have to hear this. And he, you know, in his aw shucks way, being who he is, he says, I was not learning anything anymore.
Yeah. Well, and that might be valid, too. There are others, good, solid, serious scientists. Peter Sturrock is somebody I have a huge amount of respect for, who was not ignored. But a lot of the ETH types, again, when the Sturrock panel issued its findings, its report, sort of went, ugh, because it's very sort of, none of the cases that have been brought forward prove that aliens are here, but this is interesting.
Yeah,
Science may learn something from this.
It proves that there's something here.
Yeah. And
like Jung said, something is seen, but no one knows what.
Yeah. I think what would have ticked them off the most about the Sturrock report is that they indicated that while the UFO community has done some good investigatory work at a very standard level, they're not capable, they haven't done, and they're not capable of doing the kind of investigation that's needed. And
they're not trained, and they don't have the money.
And I got news for them that that's absolutely correct. They're not trained properly. And, there is a reason why people take oral research methodology courses. How you learn how to ask the proper questions.
Right.
Just because you're a nuclear physicist, and I'm not picking on Stan here, but it's an example, just because you're a nuclear physicist doesn't mean you're a good historian.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you're a good interviewer.
Or a good hypnotherapist.
Or, yeah, you're a great artist. Doesn't make you a good hypnotherapist. So, and just because you wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning biography of T.E. Lawrence doesn't mean, you know, maybe, that you're good in some other area.
Yeah, but he was a psychologist.
I know.
That was his discipline.
I couldn't resist.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I don't really have a bone to pick with John Mack.
Neither do I.
But another guy I interviewed, my friend Mario, who died a few years ago, we were talking about this, about Hopkins and Mack, and he was a psychologist,
you're talking about,
too.
Talking about me?
Yes.
And it's kind of interesting.
Yes, yes. John Mack Tonys.
Only once on Saturdays, folks.
Yeah, Eddie. He said, you know, we were talking about abductions, and I think I printed this somewhere. These people have little respect or understanding of the subconscious, meaning there's a lot of stuff going on in people's minds that they decide to kind of push off
and
to the side.
That's where the extraterrestrial meme comes in. That's what Jung was talking about. I mean, we latch onto this, and it means so many things on so many different levels, and it just kind of, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if there is such thing as a collective unconscious, and the whole post-war attitude of fear and technology gone rampant, you know, might have spurred some projected hallucinations or something like that. I mean, it sounds like a very debunking thing, but...
No, it doesn't. It sounds like talking about something that... I don't know how you feel about John Keel, but his ideas, and Valet, and a few other people brought up in the 1960s, and young people starting in the 80s or 90s started to latch onto it, but that's about it.
I think we're being preyed upon. I think we're being shown... The UFO phenomena, you look at it closely, and you read about it enough, and to me, it's almost irresistible, the conclusion that we're dealing with something that wants to be seen. We're not dealing with stealthy alien invaders that we just happen across now and then. It's not
stealthy because it doesn't present itself in the way that our conscious scientific Western, the way we've been Aristotelian 19th century science way of presenting something is presented.
It's playful.
So,
it's
that's why it seems sneaky.
Huh? Sorry, you used Aristotelian? Man.
Aristotelian? Oh, man.
This is getting too deep for me. way too deep. You had me at valet. Oh, well.
Yeah, well, there could be many reasons for this, and I just love talking about this kind of stuff because there's very few people where you bring this up, in ufology even. I'll try and bring this up with ufologists, you know, people at conventions and stuff, and they very quickly turn away, change the subject, get confused or whatever. And I very much would have liked to talk to Jacques Vallée about it, but I thought the fact that I was sitting down and talking with him was good enough. I wasn't going to get into it with him because he's heard it all already and thought it all already, and it's embarrassing to have me spit back his ideas to him.
Look, conferences. You mentioned conferences. I saw you at the Laughlin conference this year, and I liked your lecture. There were other people. Don Ledger is a good guy, and I've heard Don's lecture on Shag Harbor, so I didn't attend it, but I assume it's as good as the other ones he usually gives. And then, unfortunately, you have to share stage time with the Billy Meyer crowd, for instance, and everybody there wants to hear about Billy Meyer. If you're going to, I once thought about running a UFO conference myself. I still toy with the idea.
I would love to do that.
And the hit list of people that I would invite in to speak.
And nobody would come.
Mac Tonys, sorry, Mac. Redfern to talk about certain things. But I'd invite Stan, too. But I would say, Stan, here's what you're going to talk about. I don't want to hear about the cosmic Watergate. I don't want to hear about MJ-12. I want you to talk about flying saucers and physics. You know, you're a nuclear physicist. You wrote papers in the early 70s and late 60s. Let's talk about the science.
Do you think he'd do it?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's great.
Stan's actually, the last I heard, he's working on a book about flying saucers and physics, going back to his roots, and I think that's something he should have done a long time ago.
You read Unconventional Flying Objects, didn't you, either of you?
I haven't.
Paul Hill?
I haven't. I'm very aware of it, but you know, I honestly can't say I've read it cover to
cover.
That's
where somebody actually did that.
Hill's a fascinating guy, very much unknown by a lot of people, not in
ufology. Well, the book came out after he died. His daughter actually went and had it published.
Hill's in our film, Top 10 UFO Cases. There's
really?
He makes a brief appearance, not like personally, literally, although maybe I'll channel him. I don't know. Bakhtar can help me out. But, sorry. But yeah, Hills had his own sighting during the Washington wave in 1952.
Yes, he describes this in the book, too.
He specifically went out looking for it.
This guy was a rocket scientist for NASA and
one of the best ever, yeah.
Before JPL, I mean, before NASA became NASA, I forgot what it was called. NACA, National Aeronautics Committee, or something like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, he wrote a book called Unconventional Flying Objects where he had a couple of sightings, and he said, well, let's take what we know about aeronautics, rockets, and all this and try and explain what's going on here and see what these guys are doing. I mean, let's assume they're extraterrestrial or somebody that actually built something physical.
Right.
And he went from that premise with his background trying to explain what had gone on. And whether he's right or not, it's a totally fascinating read.
It's interesting because he kind of reverse engineered from the behavior of the UFOs, not from actual hardware, but just from the behavior observations.
But here's the thing. How many people know Paul Hill's name? They all know, well, they don't all know, but within sort of the conference world, Billy Meier, yes, why are you even talking about Billy Meier?
The speakers will know, but the people going to the convention usually won't.
No, but you've got Paul Hellyer in Canada, who's being touted as the big breakthrough story, not just by exopolitics, by some people even outside exopolitics. Hellyer allegedly says, I knew nothing, I saw nothing, but I read Corso's book, and so aliens must be real. Instead, here's the people you should be talking about. Paul Hill, Dr. Lincoln LaPaw, the foremost expert on meteorics in the 40s and 50s, who had his own UFO sighting with his family. Yeah. Clyde Tombaugh, the guy who discovered Pluto.
Yes.
Kelly Johnson.
He's from Kansas, by the way.
Tombaugh?
The University of Kansas.
Yeah, there you go.
Really?
Kelly Johnson, man who built the U-2 and every other secret airplane
with
the U.S. ever flew.
Guy.
Yeah. I mean, and a true sort of one of the great Americans of the 20th century that most people don't remember about. Go down that list. You're not even getting into the military officers, the pilots. These are people that should know. And, you know, so Johnson had a sighting, and the Air Force said, well, it was a lenticular cloud. And this was a sighting that some of his pilots had as well. Almost nobody outside of a sort of a core group of ufologists know about the Johnson sighting. And, you know, Johnson's response, I paraphrase, I think, was something along the lines of, and it should have been if it wasn't, I think I'd know what a lenticular cloud looks like. And I think my test pilots would know what a lenticular cloud looks like, too.
Oh, is this the one that he saw off the coast of California?
Agoura. The Agoura Hills region just up the road where we'll, you know, coincidentally be filming tomorrow. Not that I'm saying that case is in my film, but, you know, it might be. But why aren't those cases talked about? And I think that's one of the mistakes ufology has made. They focused on abductions. They focused on a lot of these other things in the last 20 years. Instead, what they should have been doing is saying, look, here's a list of people, and forget Jimmy Carter, but here's a list of people who have unexplained to this day sightings, and these are some of the best scientists and the senior military leaders of our time. Dan Kimball, no relation to me, but a former Secretary of the Navy.
Uh-huh.
That one might or might not be explainable, but there's another one, Senator Russell in 55.
I don't even know about that.
In the USSR, he's traveling on a train.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And he actually
saw something take off from a field or something.
Well, flying some, I can't remember the exact, Will Wise turned me on to that one. He mentioned it to me. I'd never really heard of it before.
You could say he wised you up to it.
He wised me up twice on Saturdays. you know,
he will wise you up to more things, I'm sure.
Those are the kind of cases that people should be talking about, because those are the kind of cases that people would go, whoa, senators, you know, top scientists, top aircraft engineers and designers, that is how you get people's attention.
Yeah.
A one-armed Swiss farm, ex-security guard or whatever he is in taking pictures of beam ships, I'm sorry, there's a very limited audience for that kind of stuff, rightly so. But these other ones, that's where ufology should have been for the last 25 years. It's a point that a lot of people have made. Carl Flock made it, I think, you know, most eloquently to me, at least in person, saying that's what we should have been talking about, and we didn't, because Roswell and MJ-12 and abduction sent us off in a different direction.
I have a friend in Sedona, Arizona, who was toying with the idea of assembling a conference, and he actually made it public and had people vote on who would they have. And he made a list, and well, I guess people, some people wrote in, and he had some interesting people. He had Kaku, and he had Nick Bostrom, computer scientist, philosopher, on the whole idea that we're living in a computer simulation.
Oh, really? Yeah, I never even heard of him.
Yeah, highly respected guy, very, very, very interesting. All these very interesting people with very fresh things to say, very fresh, relevant things to say, and people wrote in because they wanted to hear Richard Hoagland and Art Bell speak. Mm. Yeah, and that was just, it's like, you know.
Well, that's what it is.
That's ufology.
The thing is, you'll have like somebody that anchors.
I think it's Art Bell, by the way. I like, but you know, he's not who I'd want to hear speak as far as
right, exactly.
He's a radio host.
No, he's a radio host and a good one.
And a good one. Right.
He's not a public speaker, and I don't think he wants to be. The thing about these UFO conferences, which some people try to do, I think Davis tries to do this with the new fog. Mm-hmm. She'll bring in some stars. You know, she'll bring in Linda Howe, and she'll bring in, you know, Bud Hopkins or whatever. But then she'll bring in other people that you don't normally hear, and, you know, 12 people will show up for their talk. But that somebody videotapes it, those get sold, it goes out on the Internet, sometimes people see it, and these memes begin to spread.
Now we got YouTube, and we got more video on the web, and that's a good thing. We'll be seeing lots more of these people, I think.
Yeah.
The problem is you don't need Linda Howe there. You know, there are people who've done serious damage to the serious study of ufology, and Linda Howe's one of them. And every time you put somebody like Linda Howe in a UFO conference.
Oh, you're talking about trying to get outside the UFO community.
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm just talking about getting information out in the first place instead of just off somebody's website or whatever.
If you want to play to your own audience, that's great. But that audience already exists.
Right,
And most of them are a lost cause, I'm afraid, at least in terms of the serious study of the UFO phenomenon and viewing it in a skeptical but open-minded way.
Yeah.
There's some people you might be able to pull back, but a lot of those people are off with their ETH, EDH. They've already made their
theory.
But you
can't get anybody to go to those conferences, like you said.
Well, I think you could. How do you know unless you try?
I hope you can. I would love it. That would be a conference that I would actually go to even if I didn't pay. I mean, even if I wasn't speaking at it, and I'd pay for it.
I think there's a lot of people who would if you marketed it right. I've got friends back home. You know, you think, oh, well, you do films or you lecture about UFOs or whatever. It's an interest of mine.
Do your friends think
you're nuts? They would if I brought in certain, you know, like people to talk about Billy Meyer. They go, well, what the hell are you doing, Paul? I bring in people to talk about the Kelly Johnson case. They'll go and they'll pay. Because when I sit down over a beer and talk to these old friends of mine and I explain, you know, top aircraft designer, blah, 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 they get interested.
Mm-hmm.
And they take the same sort of attitude that I do that, okay, there's something maybe we should take a look at here.
Right.
They'll pay. If you build it, they will come. The problem is ufology hasn't built it. They've spent all their time, instead of trying to get to the major leagues, satisfied with hitting 500 home runs in double-A ball. And it's the Crash Davis kind of thing.
Yeah,
where
you
know, you're still playing in the minor leagues, and meanwhile, SETI's up hitting home runs, you know, whether you like SETI or not. They're playing in the big leagues.
Yeah, well, they're playing in the big leagues because they're scientists that know how to move in those circles and how to get money and how to, you know, I think SETI is just about useless.
Seth Shostak, though, his one-liners, I think he could make a career as a comedian. He's very much in the entertainment industry as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
that's why he gets the
space,
funding and everything.
Exactly, exactly.
Space.com, he's a PR guy.
You can't read an article about ETI without your requisite quote by Seth Shostak saying something, you know. Just recently, the whole idea of digging in lunar soil looking for microscopic relics of extraterrestrial artifacts has become mainstream. Of course, this is something we should have been doing a long time ago.
Yeah.
But it's radical thinking, you know, and so of course everyone's talking about it in very cautious terms, you know, because they don't want to go too far, you know, into UFO land. But Seth Shostak's saying, well, he's conceding, well, yeah, okay, let's try. We won't find anything, but let's do a few hundred meters just in case. And it's like, well, where do you arrive at this figure, you know, I don't know, a square 100 meters of lunar regolith, you know?
Yeah.
Is this, I don't know.
If something exploded, maybe it would cover, you know, there'd be a millimeter of, you know.
Yeah, well, it's based on the idea that if there is space debris, and it's based on the variant of the Drake equation, but if you have different civilizations in the galaxy, and they could be very far away over geological time, bits of space debris, rocket boosted. I mean, they're thinking in terms of our own space program, which is kind of distressing, but nevertheless, what the heck, it's worth a shot. And there should be bits and pieces floating through space, microscopic. The problem is discerning what's artificial and what's not.
What do we think is artificial is something somebody else is using to construct like the growing something. It
exactly.
could be made out of some perfectly normal
organic technology.
Yeah, or inorganic thing in a normal ratios.
It's going to be like the Mars meteorite with the little microfossil all over again, you know, if we find something like that. You know, it's going to be endless debate, you know, over whether this is a little geological fluke or whether it's a little fossil or...
Right.
Well, ignore him. Seth Straub, ignore him. Ignore Jill Tarter and ignore SETI. Kyle King, who's a sort of a writer, UFO researcher down in Texas, has made the point, and I used to chuckle when Stan would say SETI, silly effort to investigate, in all his lectures. Great line, gets laughs, although diminishing laughs as the years have gone on, because most people have heard the line. So instead of laughs now, it gets nods, solemn nods of yes, of course, that's true. And I used to think it was funny, and then Kyle raised the point, he said, well, look, why are you bashing SETI? Ignore them. Or you just look petty. By continually attacking these guys who, frankly, have more money, more credibility than you do, and I don't mean Stan as you, but ufology
exactly.
in general.
Yeah.
Just ignore them and go
further.
You know, just go your own
off
road.
To the side.
Exactly.
That was a really good column. That was a good, good point.
You do your thing, and we'll do our thing, and we'll see at the end of the day. And I believe that at the end of the day, if you did our thing, and it's not my thing, but you know what I mean, ufology, properly, the way it should have been done, the way Carl Flock has said it should have been done, that you'd have more people paying more attention to you than SETI. And SETI would have long since sort of been, you know, consigned to the dustbin of history. And ufology would be viewed as something close to a true science, or at least a serious endeavor. They didn't do it. They took the wrong road, and they should have taken the other road. And there's still a chance, though, for ufology. And people get mad at me, but I keep telling
them. Not if there's people involved.
I disagree. There's still a chance because the old guard that made the mistakes did a lot of good things too, but made some fundamental mistakes about.
We're standing
where
on their shoulders, however shaky they are.
Yeah, their day is past, or it's very close to being past, and there is a new guard coming up, and those are the people that have a choice to make about which way they're going to take the serious study of the UFO phenomenon. Are they going to continue along the road they've been on, or are they going to back up, and it's going to take a backing up, and then redirect the car in a different direction.
Mm-hmm.
And I hope they choose the second option. I hope they stop, put it in reverse, pull back, and then build on the good work of guys like Stan Friedman, Dick Hall, and all those guys, but don't make some of the same mistakes that they made, and head in a different direction.
Yeah,
I think I think then people will show up at those conferences.
That's one of the best things anybody's ever said on this show.
I know. Amen.
It made me want to stand up and cheer like Stephen Greer wants people to do.
Hallelujah, brother.
Yeah. You know what? We have about 5 minutes, but we can stay if we want, a little over time. If you want to call in, 213-252-0998. While Mac and Paul are still here. And if not, we'll just keep talking for a little while. But I hope somebody heard that wants or will hear it, that wants to act on it. I certainly would. I mean, if somebody could come up with a consortium of money or something like that to get a little ball like that rolling, I would certainly be willing myself personally to try and help it organizationally or whatever. I mean that's a great idea, and I don't really think about it until I have people like you, or I have Nick on, or even John Shirley when he was on, and they say things that really resonate with me. It's like, yeah, nobody says that, nobody goes down that road, nobody is open minded about it, nobody is non threatened about when somebody says something that doesn't agree with them. Not nobody, but the people that run these conferences and things.
I think it's up to the outsiders. John Shirley, he has no personal stake in ufology, and he can say whatever he wants and do it in a fun way, in a fun, engaging way, as fiction. And,
exactly.
And he gets a message across in a way that mainstream, hardline UFO people can't.
Well, and having a sense of humor, I mean, I think I've been criticized by some, and Mac probably has too, for, you know, throwing on our blog some funny things as well. And I think, you know, at some point you need to be able to step back and laugh at it all and laugh at yourself and view it as a bit something that's amusing as well as serious. There are two sides to it.
If there's an intelligence behind the UFO phenomenon, I think it has a sense of humor. Maybe not a human sense of humor, but nevertheless a sort of playful wanting to engage us.
Maybe their normal state of consciousness is something that that's humorous to us.
I like that idea. I mean, it's interesting. I've been saying it too much.
When you get near the Dalai Lama, I saw him speak for about three straight days once, and I got that feeling. His normal state of mind is just things suck. A lot of things suck, but everything actually, reality is pretty interesting and sometimes very funny.
It's hard to achieve that state of mind, and it's nice to think that maybe someone else already has. I think we're dealing with a technology. I've used this term before, and I actually lifted it from Whitley Strieber, but I think he's onto something with this. I'm a reluctant Strieber apologist or defender sometimes, but technology.
Me too.
I like Strieber. But anyway, technology of consciousness. I think that the UFO-nauts, we talk about them in the plural, like there's more than one. This could be just if it's a machine intelligence, it could be like a distributed system,
mm-hmm.
like a computer network.
Right.
But whatever we're dealing with, I'm not sure it has evolved along the same technological trajectory as we're heading. It seems to me that it has evolved a technology of the mind itself. Whether that's quantum entangled particles in the brain or what, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it seems to work on a whole different level.
It seems to
affect consciousness directly, and I think that's something Valet has explored in depth, but I don't have a whole lot to add to that, to Valet's basic idea there. But
it brings up two things, you saying that, and they're just quotes that I remember that like kind of tie this a little bit together. One of them was from Timothy Leary, who I know you are a big fan of, and so am I. He's one of his quotes.
Increasingly so.
Yeah. One of his quotes was, "If it isn't funny, it probably isn't true." And the other one is Leonard Nimoy, when he directed the Star Trek with the whales in it, that crappy one.
Oh, was
he directed
crappy?
That?
Yes, I think that was him.
"Can you take me to your nuclear vessel?"
Some great lines in that film. I saw it in the theater, and I really liked it. I don't know if I'd like it now, but I liked it when I saw it.
He was being interviewed. He was on a friend of mine went to this, and he has no interest in UFOs or anything like that. But he was on a publicity tour for that Star Trek 3 or 4 or whatever it was. And the whales figure very prominently in that as a being living on the Earth that has some sort of say and stake in what the hell's going on here. And they asked him, "Well, what do you think whales would think, and about what we're doing and the way we do things?" And he says, "I don't think that's the right question, because I think the way they've evolved is not ahead of us or behind us, but out to another in a completely different direction."
Yeah. I like that.
It's out to the side.
I have a friend who actually, there's even more direct UFO connection. A friend who comments a lot on my weblog, and he put the idea that I never actually encountered before, that the UFO phenomenon, the humanoids, the UFO occupants, it's all hallucinatory projections by cetaceans. That's their way of communicating with us. They're psychic, and they're inducing these hallucinations and these images. I don't buy it, but I like it.
Yeah, but it's fun.
Is that like the dolphins in the Hitchhiker's Guide? No, that was a different.
It was Hitchhiker's Guide. It was so long, thanks for all the fish.
Yeah, the bye-bye fishy boys. Yeah. Although they're not fish, they're mammals, so there you go.
No, they were saying thanks for all the fish.
Yeah,
feeding them in shows and things like that.
Yeah, thanks for all the fish. It's interesting, just water. Here's something, you say Stan maybe is closed-minded. He isn't. I had this conversation with him a while ago about underwater UFOs. He was in a film, apparently a bad one, where they talked about underwater UFOs.
It was pretty bad, but I liked it. It was on Sci-Fi Channel or History or something. I watched it.
But it's an interesting subject.
A lot of Shag Harbor stuff in it.
What, 80, 90% of the planet is water, 70, 80, whatever the exact percentage is.
I think it's 70,
What if the UFOs, if they are alien spacecraft, are here for the water? Which might explain why they don't pay a whole lot of attention to us other than as seemingly a science experiment. And it might explain some UFO cases where like Shag Harbor, where you see a UFO go into the water and apparently come out of the water.
Stay down there for quite a long time.
It would make sense. It's sort of a very human-centric kind of way of looking at it, that if aliens from another planet are here, they must be here because of us.
Yeah.
It's almost the same, why don't they land on the white?
It's,
but maybe they're here for something totally different. Maybe they are here for whales. or something that we just don't understand.
Several years ago, I watched the director's cut of The Abyss, and it got me interested in this whole line of thinking. And I found Ivan T. Sanderson's Invisible Resident, which is devoted to aquatic UFOs. Mm-hmm. And good book, and interesting, lots of interesting cases. There's and a lot of it's not commonly associated with UFOs per se. It's more considered Fortean.
Exactly.
It's just out there.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
but there's
something that just doesn't belong there out in the lake or ocean or river or whatever.
Bars of light rotating around ships and stuff. And very credible accounts as well.
Yeah. William Corliss has a whole series of books on that kind of stuff called the Sourcebook Project. And there's a one whole volume, hundreds of pages, just on water anomalies.
Right.
And bars of light, like in a big spoke wheel going, passing under ships.
Right.
And they can see them rotating around a spot over the horizon somewhere, but it's coming under them out in the middle of the ocean. And this has been going on since people have been sailing on the ocean. It's not just, it didn't just happen with stuff coming out of the water at Shag Harbor, Puerto Rico or whatever.
But if we are dealing with UFOs in the air, it's very, very tempting to think that there's a link with these things under the water.
Or underground.
Because we see a lot of the morphology of the encounters is the same. Lots of wheels and rotating lights and lots of commonality there.
Yeah. We did an interview with Mac in Kansas City a few days ago where he talked about the crypto-terrestrial stuff that he's on about now.
We didn't even get to that.
Sorry, working on his book. Well,
we'll do it by phone.
www.posthumanblues.blogspot.com. Check out his blog every day. You should. There's always something interesting there every day. But he's currently blogging about extraterrestrials, crypto-terrestrials.
Yeah, get it right.
Yeah, sorry, yes. Oh, my bad. How are you getting back to the hotel? which is out in Camarillo. That's a long, it's an hour-long drive. Must be a several hours walk. we'll just drop you
off. Just go down Ventura. It goes up almost that.
You can stay over at the $2.99 for every dress store next door.
They like me, though.
Yeah, they're big fans. Note to anybody who's listening, if you show up in this general area on Vermont and Los Angeles and you walk into the $2.99 dress store and you start taking pictures of the mannequins, they start to wonder why you're there taking pictures of the mannequins.
Especially
the ones that are out front there?
And inside.
Oh, really?
It's when you go inside they get really
especially
weird.
If you're groping the mannequins.
Yeah,
they seem
no,
to think that's kind of weird.
That it's very odd. We just
it looks like a disco. Maybe they think people think it is and they get worried.
I just said, je suis Canadien. it explains so much and yet nothing. But the crypto-terrestrial stuff, I don't necessarily believe it, but it's interesting.
Well, neither do I.
No, exactly, and that's why Mac is one of those guys that people should be reading and listening to because he takes a skeptical bent, but he's not afraid to think of these things.
Yeah.
And the crypto-terrestrial stuff, some of the things that hopefully will be in my film, because my film will list the top 10 cases, but then we'll also have a segment where we'll say, okay, here's Stan Friedman talking about the extraterrestrial hypothesis. Here's Mac talking about the crypto-terrestrial hypothesis. And, a minute or two on what each of these possible explanations could be, as well as the null hypothesis and everything else.
Yeah.
But Mac made a number of really good points, very interesting points at least, I thought, about how they might be demonstrating to us. And then we started talking about the Malmstrom missile base case where they shut down all the nuclear missiles. And people have often said, the ET guys have said, well, they're here to protect us from ourselves with nuclear weapons and stuff.
Yeah, the space messiah.
Yeah. But if his theory is correct, then they're not here to protect us from ourselves. They have a vested interest in making sure we don't blow up the planet because they actually live on it. And so that might explain why they seem to have an inordinate interest in nuclear weapons sites and nuclear weapons research facilities, why they were in New Mexico in 1947 and 48 and 49.
And I think the Roswell crash could have been a balloon of sorts, but perhaps not a balloon that we sent up. Not Project Mogul, maybe a balloon with peculiar characteristics because it wasn't manufactured by humans as we know them.
Right, exactly. This is kind of the idea of my friend Walter, who used to be in the Air Force and the FBI, and he's absolutely convinced that whatever happened in Roswell was something from here and probably underground. That's his idea, and his father was in the military around the time of Roswell, and he said he heard these kind of stories.
Oh,
it's funny, you never hear that story from somebody, that suddenly this guy who was in the Air Force heard that, yes, it wasn't one of ours, but it came from under, not above.
I think that's real highly suggestive. I think that's interesting. I think that's on the right along the. That's it. Definitely fits into my little working hypothesis.
I think you're going to see in I hope about a year, Mac Tunney's. I always say Tunney's.
Yeah, it's like Tone.
Tony's. Mac yeah, Tony's yeah. on Coast to Coast, hopefully on Radio Mysterioso again.
He'll be on here again.
Not on Rents, but but on all the, Strange Days Indeed, up in Canada with Errol Bruce Knapp, talking about a new hypothesis that I think people are going to look at and say, well, maybe yes, maybe no, but it should be up there.
Well, it's easily confused with John Keel's ultra-terrestrial idea.
Well, why don't you, since we've run over our time, why don't you explain, since we brought it up at the beginning of the show, what this is and where people can go take more of a look at it?
Well, basically, the idea is that we're sharing the planet with a sister species that took a different route at some point, perhaps back when Cro-Magnon kind of diverged from Neanderthals. I'm getting a little too deep there, I guess, as far as the history. I need to get my facts straight, but I think there's some hard evidence to suggest this. There have been lots of sightings of very human, but very strangely mannered beings, and sometimes not associated with any sort of technology that we might.
No,
they just
appear and say weird things to people and do strange things.
Or you happen across in World War II. Evidently, there was an instance, and I actually got a declassified Air Force document from Nick Redfern, and it's kind of sympathetic to the idea. And I looked at it. It's about happening across. World War II is very, very intrusive geographically, and it looks like perhaps it kind of stirred up some native communities of beings that are essentially human, but not human like us. One case that continues to really fascinate me, and I think it's kind of a linchpin of the idea, and which is perhaps not wise because it could be easily debunked, is the Antonio Villas-Boas case, where you have this red-headed humanoid. But she's human, and there's every reason to think they're genetically compatible, and they have sex. But if you look at her, she's got these traits that you find again and again, whether it's in Men in Black literature or Communion. Big eyes, mm-hmm. Pointed chin, small nose, long fingers. You find that in Keel's Mothman prophecies. You find these interesting recurring traits that you see again and again. And
sounds like Spring-Heeled Jack, too.
Spring-Heeled Jack,
The Peter Corey case in Australia, Bill Chalker's book.
Big time. Yeah, Peter Corey case, definitely. And, that's another one that's totally relevant. And, in other words, I don't think we're dealing with aliens. I think we're dealing with flesh and blood. I don't think they're... you have ideas of ultra-terrestrials that exist in a higher frequency or other dimensions, something like that, and that's possible. But in fact, these crypto-terrestrials, CTs, might be able to access these other realms. But mm-hmm. ultimately, I think they're flesh and blood just like we are and exist in the physical realm and exist by means of very crafty stealth. In fact, I have a source who claims to have met some of these beings and describe them in a manner, and I actually think he's telling me the truth. In fact, I'd like to arrange a meeting at some point. But he describes them as being nomadic, and they disguise themselves as children or midgets, although they're not midgets, they're just very small, mm-hmm. like humans in miniature. And
Little people.
Little people. Yeah. They're the little people. They're the little people of...
But they won't allow anybody to toss them in bars.
Yeah. They might, if that would help.
If that would keep the planet from being turned into an oven or incinerated.
Oh, no, it's a flying crypto-terrestrial.
but if that's true, if we are sharing the planet with some very secretive species, we're reaching a point where environmentally this might not be able to go on very long. Even if they have underground bases, or even if they live underwater,
they need air.
Right, they're going to need essentially the same things we do, and they're going to be lacking some things we have. One thing is like a global infrastructure like we do, and they've taken a different route in how they do things. And I'm speaking hypothetically, obviously, but I think it's a theory that deserves to be looked at. And I think it explains some things as far as, I don't have time to go into depth about it right now, obviously, but I think it explains some things that the extraterrestrial hypothesis has a difficult time dealing with and typically chooses to just kind of avoid.
Yeah, it also seems to recall, bring up, and explain, maybe, a lot of 1950s cases with humanoids, like
even
the stuff in France,
cases.
The stuff in South America, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you said, some of the contactee cases. we hairy to, dwarves or those.
The hairy,
you know,
dwarves, exactly. We tend to throw out all these things, even the Kon-Tiki cases, and justly so in many cases.
Right.
But nevertheless, it's kind of, maybe we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. Maybe there's a nugget in there that we're dispensing that we shouldn't.
Keep an eye out for it. 2007, the book should be out.
I hope so. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're doing a book on the ultra-terrestrial.
Yeah, and it has.
I mean, crypto-terrestrial.
Yeah, I'm writing the book now, and it's just get a publisher, and hopefully it'll get a bigger one. But even if not, I don't really particularly care. I'm anxious to get it out and see where this meme goes.
That's absolutely fascinating, and it seems to follow perfectly well from everything we've been saying here today.
It even addresses some of the Valais material, you know, folklore.
Yeah.
And in a way that I think I can put on paper and make it, at least as a thought experiment, give some people pause, you know, if they'll check it out.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting idea. It's one of the things that just is fun to play with intellectually.
Exactly. And the other cool thing about it is...
It might be true.
Yeah. The other thing, the cool thing about it is if you say, Mac, you're full of crap, you'll say, yeah, maybe I am.
Right.
And go ahead. Hey, there's nothing to push against. What's wrong with you?
Then you'll sound like Nick Redfern, who says the same thing. And I'd say the same thing about myself. And that's, you know, that's the way it should be. Maybe whatever you're talking about, you might be wrong, and that applies to any walk of life. Mm-hmm. He's plugged his stuff, now I'll plug mine.
Yes,
keep an eye out for coming on Canadian television, the Space Channel, later in the summer, early in the fall. Fields of Fear, Greg is in it. He has some serious airtime in that film. It's about Fern Belzil, Canada's leading cattle mutilation investigator.
How the hell are you going to see it here?
Hopefully it'll sell to Sci-Fi in the U.S., you might be able to pick it up if you live near the border regions by satellite or whatever. Kevin Randall's in it, besides Fern, who's the focus, of course. Kevin Randall, Greg, Nick Redfern, and some other folks. So it's coming.
Nick Redfern sick.
Huh?
Nick Redfern while sick.
Yes, Nick Redfern while suffering Montezuma's revenge, which is why if you're in southern Puerto Rico, you should never have the tuna salad, even if you're at a chain restaurant. Go with the grilled cheese. And then after that, the one we're working on now, shooting now, sometime probably in the late fall, early winter, Best Evidence, Top 10 UFO Cases, again in Canada on the Space Channel, and in New Zealand on TV New Zealand. It's sold to New Zealand. Yeah, for that film, we actually have a distributor out of the United Kingdom, and they're working on selling it to the UK, Germany, France, the US, so hopefully you'll see it down here. But a lot of good people in that, Stan Friedman, Brad Sparks, Bruce McAbee, Kevin Randall, and a bunch of witnesses, too, and some cases that you've heard of, and some cases that you probably haven't heard of, but you should have. So, keep an eye out for those, too.
Absolutely amazing thing. Somebody will come on and say things like this, and yet he is a filmmaker. What other filmmaker, somebody who's going to produce something you're going to see on Sci-Fi or whatever, all these documentaries, actually has these ideas? And you've already started this. You've already started trying to get these ideas out, which I think is great. Which is maybe why you are the renowned filmmaker.
Kumbaya, my lord. At this point, we all start singing and holding hands. Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know what? I've not talked to anybody in the show that I've violently disagreed with really ever, because I don't know. I mean, I figure unless they've got a good point, but I've never violently disagreed with somebody that I thought good point.
Well,
that's just a problem.
I'm sure it wouldn't be hard, though, to find somebody.
Yeah, actually, John Shirley and I got into it a little bit.
Really?
Yeah, because he's a lot more skeptical about things than
I
am with the UFO subject.
He bills himself as a skeptical believer. He has a column at one point online.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the point, you know, there's stuff that we could disagree, I'm sure you and I have disagreed on.
Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with ufology, right?
No. It's a kind of a Bush versus Gore thing. But
I have no love for Al Gore, but it was an administration thing.
Kidding. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But even within ufology, and the thing applies with Stan and I, we disagree and agree to disagree.
Right.
The point is to talk, to have the conversation between different people with different ideas.
Yeah.
And even if you don't walk away convinced of their idea, at least you've had the conversation.
Yeah, that, and you know what? Once in a while you might learn something and realize where your argument might be falling apart.
Jesus,
he was right about that.
It's the difference between sitting in a high school history classroom where somebody's telling you something and sitting in a graduate level classroom where a group of students sit around the table and start talking about the subject. and the professor moderates and might direct you in a certain direction. But it's
you learn a lot more that way.
Yeah, it's time for ufology to stop being a junior high school or high school level endeavor and start moving up into the grad school world and talking to each other and bringing guys, if not Jacques Vallée, I don't know if he'd ever come back in a serious way, but bringing guys like Vallée back
into
the
discussion. He might with that idea.
And bringing guys like Mac in.
It'd be the visible college.
Yeah, exactly. Well, absolutely. Why should it have to be an invisible college? And why should there be... There's a laughter curtain because... And Stan's right. There is a laughter curtain. There's a giggle factor.
Yeah.
But I think it exists because, to some degree at least, because ufology has allowed it to exist and has, in fact, gone in a direction that encourages it to exist.
Yeah.
Time to change all that.
Yeah, like having a conference and putting a giant green alien waving at you with a...
Oh, no, well, that's cool. No, my conference is going to have that, too.
Oh, really? Because we went outside the Laughlin conference, Ken Thomas and I, a couple other people, and the alien was like this. I pulled his hand down. We pulled all his fingers down so he was doing this.
He's giving Laughlin the finger, yeah. Well, if he was in Laughlin, he must have been full of hot air because there's no other kind of air in Laughlin.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all hot air.
Not to sound like a rabid technophile, but getting back to Paul's... He's written all kinds of cool stuff on his blog, and I think the internet is very conducive to this. It's conducive to, Sturgeon's Law again. We're 99% of it is bad, but it also gives you a fighting chance for the people who have something to say and some intelligent debate. And I presented some weird ideas on my blog, and I get some comment by some anonymous person.
But it's an interactive medium as opposed to the other ones that are available to us.
It's almost turned into kind of a discussion board, and I've benefited from it.
Well, that's the great thing about blogging, too. Start your own blog. Go to blogger.com and start a blog. And allow comments and allow anonymous comments too.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you can moderate if it's something totally profane or whatever. You can bounce it off. You can always delete them.
Yeah.
But I've had when I ranked the 10 worst guys in ufological history, and Billy Meyer was number 5 or 6, and Michael Horn, the Billy Meyer representative in the U.S., came on and left a whole bunch of comments. It was a very long conversation. And you know what? Great, fine. I bowed out eventually. I said, look, you guys can keep talking amongst yourselves.
Yeah.
These pro and con Meyer types. I made my point, but yeah, sure. You want to use my blog to do that? Go ahead.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what I think, and then you tell me what you think, and I'll take my chances with the people who are reading that they'll think I'm right. But
right.
Talk. That's the key. Have the discussion.
And if they want to have that discussion, final plug for both of you, your sites, and so people can go there right after they get off of we get off of this show here today. Tonight.
You can always go to my blog right after you get off. And right before you get off, too, depending on the pictures I put up, redstarfilms.blogspot.com.
And you can go to my website and reach my blog via my website, which is simply www.mactonies.com, and Mac is M-A-C, and my last name is T-O-N-N-I-E-S, hence the... recurrent confusion, justifying confusion, how to pronounce that one. But that's my little plug.
And just a plug, too. If you Google Zorgrot, Zorgrot, you'll find a completely different blog. And the Carmen Electra for Earth Ambassador campaign is still ongoing. So.
And I think that's something that ufologists of all persuasions
can probably agree on. Common ground.
Yeah, at least male ones.
Yeah.
Which is 99% of them.
Yes.
So thanks so much for coming down, and I'm sure I will both have you on again, at least by phone, if not by telepathy or internet or in person, I hope. And I'm sure I will be putting this program up on the podcast area within at least a couple of weeks.
Well, you'll get a link from me.
Okay, great.
Ditto.
All right. It's been Radio Mysterioso. Every Sunday night from 8 to 10, although it's 10:21 now. Wonderful. And we'll be back next week, maybe with a guest, but probably with wacky music, which is why Paul likes listening to it.
Yay.
Should I play wacky music? I was going to play a David Bowie song, but...
Oh, you promised me Hoagy Carmichael, but...
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Let me find Hoagy Carmichael here.
If you can play the one that George Harrison covered, what was that one you played a couple weeks ago?
Hong Kong Blues.
Exactly, yes.
That's my favorite Hoagy Carmichael song because it wasn't racist for the time, but we listened to it now. It was hard to find it. I had to find it on a French import because nobody wants to release it now here because the guy says colored man and he's addicted to opium.
As I recall, you can find it on George Harrison's album somewhere in England, or was it it's one of the ones in the early 80s, so which you didn't know.
No, I didn't. I also didn't know that calling occupants of interplanetary craft was not originally recorded by the Carpenters. It was Klaatu.
Yeah.
Remember that band?
Yeah.
I have to find that one now. It shouldn't be that hard.
And there's the Harrison reference. When Klaatu first came out, a lot of people thought it was the Beatles reformed. And that died very quickly. But
well, we'll play Hong Kong Blues, and then we'll play a Bowie song. Actually, my favorite Bowie song changes from time to time.
How about Life on Mars?
I don't know if I have that on my iPod. It wasn't even going to be a space thing. I was going to play
Let's
Queen
Dance.
Bitch because I like that song.
I had a dream a few weeks ago where I was performing this song, this David Bowie song.
Which one?
I suppose Life on Mars.
Oh, really?
You don't like Let's Dance?
I can't stand that song. Here we are with the Paul song, and then we'll play one, the Mac one.
Story of a very unfortunate colored man who got arrested down in old Hong Kong. He got 20-year privilege taken away from him when he kicked old Buddha's bone. And now he's popping up Vienna just to raise the price of a ticket to the land of the free. Well, he say his home's in Frisco where they ship the rice, but it's really in Tennessee. That's why he says, I need someone to love me, need somebody to carry me home to San Francisco and bury my body there. I need someone to lend me a $50 bill and then I'll leave Hong Kong far behind me for happiness once again. Won't someone believe I've a yen to see that day again? But when I try to leave, sweet opium won't let me fly away. I need someone to love me, need somebody to carry me home to San Francisco and bury my body there. Fortunate colored man who got rested down in old Hong Kong. He